Parshas Vayeshlach contains one of the most striking, hair-raising narratives in the Pentateuch, the massacre of Shechem. We know that basic facts are pretty stark. Yaakov's daughter Dinah is taken by Shechem, prince over there. Actually, it's actually noteworthy. If you read the Pesukim carefully, nowhere does it explicitly say that it was rape. It says he took her, Vayidabra Eliba. It generally assumed that it was rape. It says Vayaneha, which not clear what that means, but we can assume that it was by force against her will, against her parents' will, against her family's will, a young girl. So Shechem, with apparently the cooperation or not cooperation of his family, took Dinah, molested her. Yaakov's family was outraged, particularly her brothers Shimon and Levi. They entered into a duplicitous treaty deal with the inhabitants of Shechem. They said that we'll give you our daughter, and in general, we will intermarry with you. We just need one thing. You have to agree to become circumcised as we are. So the Pesukim say that they agreed. They thought this was a good idea. So the entire male population of Shechem, we don't exactly know how big Shechem was, but the entire male population of Shechem underwent Bris Milah. And on the third day, B'yozim Kavim, the third day in Torah and Gemara generally is when Bris Milah is the worst. Some say the pain actually gets worse for 3 days. Some say it's just cumulative. It's the having pain for 3 days that makes it bad. Whatever it is, the third day is a particularly rough point in the Bris Milah. So it says that Shimon and Levi came. It says Shimon and Levi came to the city. They found them. They approached them. Betach. The pasuk says, "Vayivo al hayir betach vayagru kol zachar." They came to the city secure. There are different pshatim in the commentators what secure means. Some say that they were secure in the chesavos, the merit of their fathers. I was talking to my father last night. He reminded me of a kliyakar, first item on the page. Kliyakar says something wry, perhaps poignant, and of considerable resonance today. He says, why were they so secure? Why were they not worried? As we see at the end, Yaakov was actually pretty worried that this could have blowback. Kliyakar says, They assumed they were secure that the Kanani, the Prizi, that the other Canaanite inhabitants of Eretz Canaan wouldn't lift a finger to avenge the people of Shechem. Ki yomru me'achra shenichnesu b'das animolim eina mishalonu b'yisya'a shumehem. As my father puts it, if people kill Jews, you know, nobody cares. Once they're Jews, the world sympathy is no longer particularly mine. They're yours, they're not ours anymore. Nobody cares if they get murdered. But in any event, it says that Shimon and Levi massacred the entire city of Shechem. We don't know how big it was. The Ralbag has a somewhat macabre explanation for how it was that two men could massacre an entire city. He says the entire male population had undergone Bris Milah. They were being treated. It was the third day of their Bris Milah. So Shimon and Levi were the medical attendants. They went from house to house. They shoot out all the attendants. They went to visit the sick person, cut his throat or whatever, quietly closed the door behind them. They told the family, leave him alone. He has to rest. Under no circumstances are you to disturb him for the next 4 hours or whatever it was. And so on. They went to the next house, and one by one, they wiped out the entire city in that fashion. So after they destroy the entire city, it says that Yaakov was not pleased. Yaakov, their father, said, Achartem osi, you have sullied me, you have muddied the water. Lavisheni b'yoshif haaretz, you have made us stink, you've made us foul in the eyes of the inhabitants of this land, of Eretz Canaan, Bakanani, Vaprizi, in spite of their assumption that now they're Jews, nobody cares about them. Yaakov didn't think that was a decisive argument. Vanimase mispar, we, Yaakov said, our family, there are only a few of us. Vinesfo alai, vikuni, they're going to gather against us and march against us and smite us. Vinishmaditani uvesi, we're going to be exterminated. Vayomru, they responded, Hachazone Yasis Hachasenu. They said, Shall he treat our sister like a zone? That was their answer. So the dialogue here is striking. It's very much they aren't responding to Yaakov's argument. Yaakov wasn't saying they don't deserve it. Yaakov wasn't saying the poor people are innocent, we should have left them alone. Yaakov was saying, he was making a very cold, real political argument. He was saying we're not strong enough to stand against the assembled wrath of Eretz Canaan. So it just doesn't make sense. We're not going to live through this. So whatever reason you might have had for doing this, it's a bad idea. And they answered, they didn't discuss the likelihood of surviving or anything. They just said, they can't do this. They can't treat our sister like a zona. So what was the answer? Yaakov said, you're right, but it's dangerous. And they said, well, it's intolerable. So what exactly is the disagreement there between Yaakov and his sons, and related question, who was actually right? Who was the who does the Torah side with in the after the fact? Yes.
Is it true that I think I remember from the story that he did whatever in the act that he did, but he loved her, and there might have been some indication that she was willing to go along with this deal, and then he sent his father to go get permission to marry her, and they.
So the text of the biblical account does say Vayidaber Eliba, that he tried to persuade her. The Torah does not really clearly state the outcome of his persuasions. There are certain midrashim that she was unwilling to come home. I think the Medrash says she was too humiliated to want to leave. It doesn't say that she was interested in him, I think, but the Medrash I'm familiar with says she was just too devastated to be willing to show her face in Yaakov's house again. Those are interesting ideas, but I'm not going to be going in that direction. I'm just discussing what I just want to discuss what the motivation of Shimon and Levi was, and what her perspective is certainly an important one, but I'm not going to be focusing primarily on her perspective tonight. Now, the commentators, the better known discussion, I think, about Shimon and Levi's massacre, deals with it from a somewhat legalistic perspective. Ramban, Rambam, they discuss why, under Torah law, under halacha, what right did the sons of Yaakov have to murder the city? So the Rambam says it was because he had been guilty of kidnapping or theft of person, a form of kidnapping. The city as a whole was guilty of failure to enforce law and order, failure to enforce judgment against an oppressor. Ramban himself says they were just guilty of all the abominations of Canaan, the Torah. Why do we need to look for reasons? Ramban says, are there any lack of capital crimes committed by the old inhabitants of Canaan? The Torah always tells us they were pretty low on the morality scale. But what I want to focus on tonight is a slightly different, somewhat very different perspective, not the legalistic attitude toward what sin had they committed. Nothing against legalism. I just want to discuss it from a different angle tonight. I want to discuss more as a question of policy and as a question of personal feelings, what motivated Shimon and Levi to do what they did, why did they do it, particularly in light of Yaakov's concern, which they didn't disagree with necessarily, that they were risking their lives to do this, that they were risking retaliation from the unified inhabitants of Canaan. Specifically, what was this dialogue between Yaakov and Shimon and Levi? Yaakov says, this is very dangerous, and they said, Hachazona Yaseh Sachosein. So there's a very striking discussion of this in the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel, number two here, says as follows. He says, the general point that Shimon and Levi were making, he says, Shala kolon hazeh, kolon, disgrace, ignominy, this disgrace, they were mechuyavim, they were obligated, morally obligated to give up their lives, to risk their lives, to put themselves in mortal danger. Why? And the highlighted sentence here, ki amoves b'chavod tova mechai hacherpa v'haboz. Death with honor is preferable to a life of shame and disgrace. And Barbanello goes on and he says, we asked earlier, who is actually right here, Yaakov or Shimon and Levi? We see Yaakov apparently hasn't given in. He hasn't accepted this answer. Many years and years later, on his deathbed, it's when he gives the blessings and curses to his blessings mostly to his sons, he talks about Shimon and Levi. He says, Orurapam kiaz, vevrasim ki kashasa. He cursed their anger, their wrath. He says it's out of control. We have to disperse them. We have to blunt their anger. He still seems to feel they had done wrong. Certainly that's the Midrashic explanation. But the Abarbanel, remarkably, in this right here, says, Kfar hiskim das amakam baruchu. God agreed to the position, the stance of Shimon and Levi. When the Torah goes on and it says that they did not actually face terrible retaliation from Canaan, the Torah says, the fear of the Lord, a terrible fear of Yaakov's sons, was upon the surrounding cities. They didn't attempt to strike back. The Abarbanel understands that was, you can argue that was simply Hashem's compassion or Hashem's providence for Yaakov, but he says, no, they were right. That Hashem agreed, Hashem endorsed what they had done. And the Abarbanel goes on, he says, one of the lessons from the story in general, this is such an important point, he says, that when you're dealing with Anshei Hamala V'Akavod, men of better quality, so to speak, men of lofty stature and honor, that any cherpa and kolon, any disgrace and shame that's done to them, yesimu nafshem b'chapam, they risk their lives, they risk everything, risk their whole families, to avenge the slight on their honor. This is truly a remarkable thing. Honor, this type of thing, kind of spans cultures. We have the Japanese with their seppuku and harakiri, the idea that if you're dishonored, you kill yourself. If you let your lord down, you kill yourself. Better to kill yourself and fall into the hands of the enemy. It's an ancient Japanese idea. We have it in the black rap musicians, the fight between the East and the West Coast rappers. They kill each other because of embarrassing songs. And lest anyone think this is some kind of inner city pathology, this was a sitting vice president and a former secretary of state got into a duel because he wrote a nasty editorial piece about him, a nasty slight against his character. They were dueling with pistols in New Jersey. This is something that kind of spans cultures. We find this notion that an insult to your honor, that you're dishonorable if you let it stand, that somehow risking your life, you're either trying to kill the other guy or risking your own life, is somehow worth it, is somehow an honorable man doesn't let himself get insulted and just take it lying down. It seems, to our kind of maybe modern 21st century minds, this all seems kind of atavistic and barbaric, but that Abarbanel says that this is actually, this is the correct attitude that is held by Anshei HaMaila V'Hakavod. And as we said, we find it across cultures. Now, what we can argue that the Abarbanel was, it has to be remembered, a Spanish grandee. He was a nobleman high in the court of the Spanish and Portuguese monarchs. One suspects that this was a kind of a Spanish idea that was rubbing off on him. The Abarbanel repeats this actually later in Chumash Dvarim. At least one other place he says the same thing. He says that before battle, the Kohen, the Shoter, they would make announcements that anyone who's scared should leave the frontline troops and go home, lest he damage the morale of the army. So unlike Chazal, who say that some of the questions were mixed together with other questions about who has a new wife and a new house, not to embarrass anybody who is actually returning, Abarbanel takes the opposite approach. He says these questions were deliberately asked in public. People were given the option of retreating, but they would have to do so in front of all their comrades, in front of the whole nation. And he says this was meant to shame them, and this was meant to inspire people. People should say, rather I fight like a man and risk death and maybe I'll die than be permanently humiliated by being branded a yellow-lily-livered coward and walking home. This was supposed to be, again, an inspiration to people that right-thinking people understand that as a matter of honor, better death with honor than a life of disgrace. Now, I don't think, as I said, you're allowed to say this is the influence of Spanish culture or not, this is certainly not, I think, the mainstream approach in the Jewish tradition. In number 7 at the bottom, I reproduced a couple of paragraphs from the Reshiva of Aaron Lopiansky's book. He has an essay a couple of decades ago, I think, originally written. Apparently there was some kind of Masada fever going through the U.S. There was a miniseries, I think. Masada was very prominent in American culture at the time. The heroism, the last stand kind of mythos that had developed around Masada. So we don't actually know what happened there. We rely on Josephus mostly, who is the quintessential unreliable narrator, as Rav Aaron discusses in his essay. But basically the story, at least in the popular imagination, Josephus' story is that there was a band of Jewish resistance, freedom fighters, resisting the yoke of the Roman rule, that were holed up in Masada, a great tactical position. They held out for a long time. Eventually they were going to get overwhelmed, starved out, whatever the issue was. So they realized they were going to fall into the Roman hands, die, tortured, captivity, slavery, whatever it was. So to a man, or almost to a man, they all killed themselves rather than fall into the hands of the Romans. And this was held as being an incredible act of bravery, of honor, of psychological resistance to the Roman rule. We know the story, of course, because Josephus survived. Every one of them died, and the Romans weren't telling the story. We know the story because Josephus survived, and the way he tells the story, they had thrown lots. They had all, I think, 900 men. They had arranged for a series of lots to be thrown to determine who would kill whom, and so on and so forth, until everyone was dead, and the last man would kill himself. Josephus and an accomplice rigged the lots. This is actually a mathematical problem. There's a whole Wikipedia page on it. how to solve it, how to make sure you're the one who survives if you have control over the initial conditions. He managed to throw the game so he would survive, and then he defected to the Romans and lived to tell the tale, became a prominent Roman citizen, famous historian, had a comfortable career for the rest of his life as a citizen of Rome. That's why we have Josephus, one of the most important, if not wholly reliable, narratives of this story and of stories of the Churban Bayis Sheni and the aftermath in general. So if you accept Josephus' story, which again, he's often accused of being a little bit self-serving, but if we accept his story, this is what the men of Masada did. They all killed themselves, almost all killed themselves, rather than fall into the hands of the Romans. So the Reshiva has a discussion of whether what the Torah would think about such conduct, and he does not approve. And regarding specifically regarding the question of honor, he notes that, you know, there might be certain justifications for committing suicide. We know in Tanakh, we know that Shaul HaMelech killed himself or had himself killed rather than fall into the hands of the Plishtim. There are other stories of suicide in the medieval period and during the Crusades. There's a lot of literature about this in the Bali Tosfos and so on. So there are cases in which suicide would be justifiable. But the Reshiva says, the story of Masada emphasizes their honor and heroism. He says, Halacha and Ashkafa clearly says that honor is a foreign word to the Jew. We must do what is right, not what seems honorable. We surrender only for the following reasons: to save lives, to save Klal Yisrael. We commit suicide for Kiddush Hashem, for no other reason, and so on. And there's no question, I think, that is the mainstream Jewish approach. The comments of the Abarbanel notwithstanding, the mainstream Jewish approach, I think, doesn't have this Japanese or hip-hop or European notion of honor. But nevertheless, I always like to say that there are very few ideas that are so foreign to Judaism that we can say definitively that has no place in Judaism. The Abarbanel at least felt that this notion of honor does indeed have a place within Judaism. We should also note that another... That's a fair point, yeah. Had they asked him, or presumably they knew what they didn't ask him because they knew what he might have said. Yes, yeah, there are questions about what Yaakov doesn't seem to have an in on it, so there's no question that honoring your parents' wishes is an important value in any value system. How they decided that this kind of honor outweighs the honor of listening to their parents is an interesting question. I don't know. It's a valid point, certainly. There's a very interesting comment of the Radak also. So we're often told that a single line or a single word of one of the Rishonim, of one of the medievals, can carry a great deal of latent meaning. So there's a comment of the Radak, I don't have it reproduced here, literally one line. He says, regarding this dialogue between Yaakov and Shimon and Levi, he says, Yaakov pachad kimin hago, v'shimon v'levi hayu avirei lev. Yaakov worried, as was his custom, and Shimon and Levi were stout-hearted. Now, it's remarkable in the Machshava system, the Midah often associated with Yaakov is Emes, Titan Emes LiYaakov. If you actually read, though, a simple reading of Sefer Bereishis indicates that Yaakov has a different Midah associated with him, and that is worry. I don't know if there's anyone in Chumash who's described as worrying as much as Yaakov. If you list on your fingers all the cases where Yaakov is worried, he worries about Lavan going down to Lavan. He worries about Esav. When he steals the brachas, he's worried about... Originally, he's worried that Yitzchak will find him and catch him, and he'll be seen as a thief. When he runs from Lavan, he's worried about what Lavan will do to him. He tells Lavan, I was worried what you would do to me. When he comes back to Esav, he's worried about Esav. When he first sends Yosef down to see how the brothers are doing in Vayeshev, he says, see how your brothers are doing, make sure they're okay. He's worried about them. Later, of course, he worries about Yosef with good reason, although Yosef was alive. When they want to send down Binyamin, he's worried about what will happen to Binyamin. And here at Shechem, he's worried about what will happen to them from the retaliation of Canaan. So Yaakov, to some extent, that's what the Radak, I think, is indicating. Yaakov worries. Yaakov is a person who worries a great deal. So that's what the Radak says. Yaakov pachad kimin hago. V'shimon v'levi hayu avirei lev. Shimon and Levi were bolder. The Radak is not necessarily saying who was right, who was wrong. The Rambam, actually, in Shmona Prakim, does actually say that Yaakov's worry was taken a little too far. that Yaakov was a little too nervous, perhaps. But either way, that the Radak is suggesting is kind of insinuating that the disagreement here had to do with personality. It wasn't just a cold question of calculation or disagreements about values, that it had to do with temperament. Yaakov worried more, and Shimon and Levi worried less. Another couple of interesting approaches to the disagreement here between Yaakov and Shimon and Levi are found in the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh. The Aruch Chaim directly poses the question. He says, number three here, he says, we have to understand, Ma tshuva zu osa? What was the answer? Achazone yasis achaseinu? How does that resolve the concern of Yaakov? He gives two very interesting approaches. First approach, again, relevant to our what to do today, he says, is that that they were telling Yaakov, it's true, if we launch an unjustified, unprovoked attack on the natives, then their friends will be very upset and they will counterattack. However, people will recognize that the right is with us. People will recognize that they struck first, that they perpetrated an outrage which cannot be left unanswered, and therefore they won't attack us because they'll understand that what we did was justified, and they'll leave us alone. So even Canaan, you know, I always wonder what the media was like then, what the NGOs used to say back then, what the international organizations and the International Criminal Court, you know, what these types of institutions would have said. But even back then, in the 3,000 years ago, the Aruch Chaim felt, at least Shimon and Levi felt, that there was enough of a sense, even among the pagans and the barbarians of the time, that there's such a thing as fair retaliation and such a thing as unprovoked retaliation, and as long as you can do the proper hasbara and make sure they understand why we did what we did, maybe this is rose-colored glasses or naive optimism, but Shimon and Levi felt, they were young, I guess, I don't know if they were right, but they felt that the pagan Canaanites would understand that their lashing out was justified and they wouldn't feel the need to strike back. The second idea of the Aruch Chaim is also a remarkable idea. He says, Shimon and Levi's answer was nothing to do with honor, nothing to do with passion and honor. It was an entirely cold-blooded response to Yaakov. They actually were debating Yaakov's claim that this would endanger them. Shimon and Levi said, on the contrary, what we did is going to secure our safety. And the Aruch Chaim says Shimon and Levi were engaged in the cold-blooded calculus of deterrence. Shimon and Levi were telling their father, if we let an outrage like this go unpunished, then it's open season on the family of Yaakov. People know they can do such a thing and get away with it, then that's it. Then we're finished. They said this way, they know that if someone starts up with the family of Yaakov, the result is an immediate bloody act of vengeance. The next person who thinks of doing something like this is going to think twice and is going to say, look what happened last time, I'm not getting involved. And that's what the Torah says, that's what they meant. B'zeh tiyeh chitasim al ha'amim. He's referring to the language of the Pasuk again, v'tehi chitas Elokim al ha'arim. They said this is the way to secure the peace. This is the way sometimes you have to do something like this. This is how we're going to be more safe, not by rolling over and ignoring insults like this. So Aruch Chaim is not coming to say who was right or who was wrong, but he definitely seems to be at least somewhat sympathetic to the argument of Shimon and Levi that bloody retaliation sometimes is the way to preserve deterrence and thereby to preserve the peace. This is an idea that actually makes its way into the later halachic literature. We have a number of sources in the poskim of later generations who do articulate explicitly a value that it is a halachic obligation upon Jews, upon the community, to practice deterrence and to make sure that when outrages occur, that they are punished to the best of our ability. The classic tshuva on this is the Tzemach Tzedek, the early one from Nicholsburg. He was asked about a case that a non-Jew had murdered a Jew, and they had a pretty good idea of who it was. But bringing him to justice was expensive. It cost, today we would say it cost the legal fees. Back then he refers to it as schar melitzos for shchadim. There were some bribes that had to be paid. Palms had to be greased. There were melitzos, I guess, like lawyers, advocates. It cost money. Justice always costs money. So basically bringing the perpetrator to justice was an expensive proposition. So the halacha question posed to him was, do we as Jews have the duty to do so? Does the family have a duty to do so? Does the community have a duty to do so? So he has a very interesting discussion. Some of it deals with obligation of the family, a point that maybe we'll return to a little bit later. But the paragraph of the tshuva that I have excerpted here, number four, he deals with a communal obligation to pay whatever it costs to bring the murderer to justice. He says, why is this so important? What's the imperative? He says, "Kidei ligdor hapirza," to forestall a breach in communal security. Shem chas v'shalom lo yinokim in eretzeach, if we don't avenge murders, then yeh daman shel bnei bris chas v'shalom kehefker, then the blood of Jews will be hefker, and people will do this again, people will murder Jews again, everyone will be in danger, he says, and therefore this is a general communal public need, and the public has an obligation to bring the murderer to justice, because that will secure the safety of everyone. He says the Parnasei Hadar, the communal leaders, have the imperative. They have to arrange Golem, blood avengers, kind of like the Gal Hadam. We'll discuss that a little more later. They have to appoint people whose job it is to secure justice, to chase the murderers. And even if we know we're not going to win sometimes, even if we know it's an uphill battle and we don't really have a strong enough case or he's too powerful for us to get him, they have to know that we're going to do whatever we can, that we're going to try, that we're going to do whatever we can to show that we don't take this kind of thing lightly. And again, the key phrase is, she'ema forsum, it has to be clearly established, she'ein damo shel bnei bris hefkeru, people have to know that there's a price to be paid for spilling Jewish blood. He's not encouraging vigilantism or any kind of Jewish Defense League or anything like that. He's not discussing that. He's simply discussing engaging the legal process. He's saying that there's a mitzvah to do this, there's an imperative to do this, because that is what keeps the community safe. No, he does not. I
there are pretty much contemporary historical stuff. The Regina Rebbe was, for example, consulted on the case of coppers and whatnot, and they killed the guy. In fact, that's why Regina Rebbe won. That's not why we have the Sadegoro Rebbe. He had to flee the country.
Yes, so vigilantism is something that there is definitely a body of literature on that. He's not discussing that. I don't mean to say he disagrees with that. I just mean that this is response to literature. It wasn't the question he was asked. The question he was asked, it wasn't practical, and that wasn't the issue, whatever it was. He was asked specifically about, I just wanted to articulate that just that's what he's talking about. We will perhaps return to the question of taking the law into our own hands, vigilantism, a little bit later. But the question he was asked was the legal process. And there are similar tshuvas, a couple of other tshuvas saying similar things around the turn of the 20th century. One of them is the Divrei Malkiel, after number 6 here. Divrei Malkiel, or Malkiel Tenenbaum, he was asked a very interesting and modern kind of question. His question was, again, a Jew had been murdered. They had an idea of who it was. I think, again, it was believed to have been a non-Jewish murderer. Now, what the Jews were contemplating doing was filing a criminal complaint with the government, Poland, or wherever it was. The issue here wasn't the cost. The cost was not the question here. The question was, they knew, the law was, that if a criminal investigation was opened, that would trigger a forensic disinterment of the body. The body had already been buried, the victim's body, and the Jews weren't going to do the autopsy, but they knew that part of the forensic protocol would mean that the body would be disinterred as part of the investigation. The Jews wouldn't have to do it themselves, but the question was, they were being gorem, they were indirectly causing a, what normally would be called nivul ames, a halachically prohibited disgrace or shaming of the body. So they wanted to know, is this appropriate? Should we leave the case alone, maybe, because it's going to result in disrespect to the deceased? So the Divrei Malkiel said unequivocally, no, you should file the complaint, and even if it will trigger the autopsy. And he has several arguments. One of his arguments is that the need to preserve deterrence. He said, the same argument as the Tzemach Tzedek, he says that it's important to make sure that the community stays safe, and we have to make sure that murderers are punished, and even if that involves disgrace for the Mace, he himself would be okay with it. He has other arguments, which we'll return to a little bit later, but one of his arguments is deterrence, the idea that we have to keep the community safe by punishing murderers. We also have a tshuva number 5 from the Imre Shefer. That is the always fascinating Rabbi Leo Kalatskin, a little known today, but a leading Polish posek, again, of the turn of the 20th century. He always has something interesting to say. In this tshuva, he says, he's talking about autopsies in general, when they're permitted, when they're not. So he says, when the cadaver in question, when the deceased in question is the victim of a murder, and he says sometimes the relatives out of out of sensitivity toward the body of the family honor or the body of their relative, try hard to prevent a forensic autopsy. He says, through this, sometimes this results in the investigation being stymied and the murder going unsolved or unpunished. He says, flat out, unequivocally, they are wrong. He says, certainly the mace himself, the victim, would be mochlal b'zyono. One of the key criteria we always use in determining whether a given form of nivul, of bizayon for the mace is permitted, is what do we think the person himself would say if he were here. He says, certainly he would want us to uncover his murder. And he says, adrabi, he says, on the contrary, the correct attitude according to the Torah is yeshel seyel p'kide hamamshala, we should aid and help the government officials. Levar hadarver l'anshu b'mishpat, we should help them in their investigation, even if that means an autopsy, and we should help them solve the crime and bring to justice whoever did it.
Would that be the same for a Jew and another Jew, or just a non-Jew?
So that's a very good question. How do these halachas, are there distinctions made between Jewish and non-Jewish murders? So that actually takes us to number six. Number six is an earlier tshuva of the Chavos Yair. He actually was asked about a Jewish murder. I made a point of saying these previous tshuvas were about non-Jewish murders, at least the first two, the Tzemach Tzedek and Devar Malkiel, just because there might possibly be differences, might not, it's not entirely clear. But the Chavos Yair was asked about a Jewish murder. His case was a little more complicated. In his case, what happened was this Jew, today maybe they'd call him a kid at risk, he had fallen into bad company, he had run with a bad crowd, he had become a gangster. He had murdered somebody in the course of his life of crime. He had gotten away with it. He was actually not caught for that. He eventually was caught for stealing, for larceny of some sort, which was a capital crime in Europe back then. And he was on death row for larceny, not for the murder, which he had gotten away with. So the question that had faced the Jewish community was, what attitude should they take? Should they encourage the government to execute him? Not, of course, for theft. In Judaism, we don't execute for theft, but we do execute for murder. So should they encourage the government to execute him because he's a murderer and he deserves the death penalty? Should we attempt to get him off? Should we encourage the government to let him go? Or should we do nothing? Should we shave al tassit? Should we do nothing and let the local system of justice run its course without any interference from us? So there were those who had argued that based on the principle of Goel Hadam, of blood vengeance, that even if we can't do it ourselves, then we should encourage the government to kill him because he is a murderer and he deserves to be killed. There were those who argued we should encourage the government to let him go because he's a Jew, and as long as he hasn't been judged by the Sanhedrin with full due process of capital jurisprudence as defined by halacha, he isn't deserving of the death penalty. So the Chavos Yair makes a number of complex and intricate arguments, and his conclusion, to cut to the chase for a moment, his conclusion is, Sheval Taseh, we should do nothing. We should not encourage the government to kill him. He makes numerous arguments why the paradigm of Goel Hadam is not applicable. We should also, however, he says, not encourage the government to let him go, because he is a murderer. And as he points out repeatedly throughout this tshuva, a remarkable expression, he says, when you're discussing the disposition of a murderer, you can't just say, be machmer and let him go, he says, because on the contrary, there are two people involved here, he says. There's the murderer, and there is the murder victim, he says. Any leniency that you get, that you obtain for the murderer is harmful, so to speak, to the murder victim. And he posits an extraordinary doctrine. We're familiar with ghost stories, campfire stories, Harry Potter, wherever you hear this stuff, that the victim of a murder does not rest until his murderer is brought to justice. I think there's a character like that in Harry Potter who runs around haunting the place because, you know, he's been a murder victim. But this is an old European idea. It goes back in European traditions, many forms. And the Chavos Yair acknowledges that this is a folk belief, but he says this actually is the belief of the Torah too. He and others quote various midrashim to this effect. The most famous is probably the story of the blood of Zechariah. We talk about it on Tisha B'Av. The story is that in the end of the First Temple, the Jews, who had reached a pretty depraved state, they had committed all kinds of perversions, and they didn't want to hear reproof from the prophets. So when Zechariah began to do as the prophets did and lecture them on the evil of their ways, they murdered him. What happened was the blood of Zechariah wouldn't simply soak into the ground and be absorbed. The blood of Zechariah continued to boil. The Medrash details the story in literally gory detail, that when Nebuzaradan, I think it was, invaded Yerushalayim, and he saw the blood boiling, and he asked, "What is this?" And they tried to push him off. They told him it's karbanos, it's other things. He did a comparison test. He slaughtered animals. So it wasn't the blood of karbanos. He told him he would destroy them all if they told him what it was, and they told him, "Oh, it's the blood of a kohen v'navi." We say in Echa that one of the unforgivable sins of the Jewish people was the murder of a kohen v'navi. That was a reference to Zechariah, who was both a kohen and a navi, and he had been murdered in cold blood. So Nebuzaradan then began to slaughter Jews to appease Zechariah, and he had killed, I think, thousands or tens of thousands before he turned to God and said, "Do you want me to wipe out the whole Jewish people?" And then the blood stopped boiling. But the Chavos Yair and others basically take this as a paradigm. Hamlet is the other, when I wrote about this last, Hamlet is one of the classic accounts of this. They see the ghost of the murder victim who's restless because his murder needs to be avenged. So Chavos Yair says this is a genuine Jewish idea, that the blood of the murder victim does not rest until the murderer has been avenged, and therefore it actually is a need of the victim himself to have his murder avenged. So you can't just say, let the murderers go, because there's a price to pay. We discussed earlier deterrence. The other price to pay is it's not fair. The victim doesn't get closure, spiritual closure. Therefore, the Chavos Yair's conclusion is, Sheval Tase, don't do anything and let the secular justice system run its course without interference from us. Divrei Malkiel, in the tshuva I mentioned earlier, makes the same point. He says that it is good for he was discussing not what they should do to the victim. He was discussing not what they should do to the murderer. He was discussing, is there an issue of nivel hames? Is it a problem if we file the criminal complaint, which will trigger the autopsy, which is normally considered nivel hames? So his answer is, as we said before, the mace himself would desire this outcome. The victim himself would appreciate if we did whatever it takes to catch his murder. And he again develops the same doctrine that it is good for the mace to have his murder avenged, and therefore the mace himself would like it, and therefore there is no issue of nivel hames. So these tshuvos, I think, are representative of at least some of the, this is, I think, the standard literature that's quoted on the importance of avenging murderers, both for deterrence as well as for the purpose of benefiting the soul of the victim himself. Now, the question earlier came up about vigilantism, about taking the law into our own hands. That takes us to the topic of Goel Hadam, something which perhaps we'll get to sometime in greater detail. But just in outline, the Torah has in various places the idea of, the Chumash has the idea of Goel Hadam, that if someone is murdered, then the relatives of the family have a right, or perhaps even a duty, to avenge the murder. The Torah gave us Arei Miklat, cities of refuge, sanctuary cities where the murderers can run if they were shogeg, if they were not really grossly negligent or culpable, and in the sense of having done it deliberately. The idea of an Arei Miklat where they can run and seek refuge from the Goel Hadam. But there is an institution of Goel Hadam, which is that relatives of the victim have the, again, either duty or right, at least, the debate in the Gemara, to avenge the blood of their relative. Now, this appears in the Talmud and the Rambam, of course. There isn't that much about this in Shulchan Aruch, but nevertheless, there is a small but interesting literature on Goel Hadam. We do actually have some testimony, some evidence that this practice was still practiced in the medieval period, that people did still avenge murders. There actually is, this actually makes it into the Mishnah Berurah, even in Hilchos Shabbos. There is a terse and somewhat ambiguous tshuva of the Maram Mirzberg, I think, going back to 14th or 15th century, about a case where the Goel Hadam, the blood avengers, chased somebody down. It's not clear whether this was a Jewish murderer or a non-Jewish murderer on Shabbos, and then they killed him. They brought him to justice or killed him, doesn't say what they did exactly, but they had to actually violate Shabbos and travel outside the Tchum to do this. Tchum is not as serious as or Malacha Daraisa, but they did violate Shabbos to some extent, and the answer was they did right. They did the correct thing. The halacha is that we know that the avoda, the temple service, overrides Shabbos. We bring certain karbanos on Shabbos, communal sacrifices, and we know that punishing a rotzeach is doche the avoda. The halacha is me'im mizbechi tikachenu lamus. Even if a kohen wants to do the avoda, but if he's guilty of a capital crime, we take him away to execute him. So the Gemara says, you see from this that at least an idea that in certain circumstances, the need to enforce justice and execute people can be more important than Shabbos. So the Mara Mirzberg rules that there is such a thing. Marival, Mara Mirzberg rules there is such a thing that in certain cases, at least, again, he doesn't give us that much detail, but he says there is this idea that not only is Goel Hadam still practiced to some extent, it even can override Shabbos, at least in the case in question. And there are a handful of other tshuvas that discuss the idea of Goel Hadam that indicate that it was to some extent practiced in the medieval period. We don't have a lot of literature on it, and the literature is not that clear, but we do have a few sources which seem to indicate pretty unambiguously that strongly indicate that there was some type of practice of Goel Hadam in the medieval period. Now, from the legalistic perspective, from the halachic perspective, there's a lot of debate about this. As we kind of hinted earlier, some poskim argue the Chavos Yoyer, you need a beis din. Someone has to paskin. We can't just allow complete vigilantism. Some poskim argue you need a beis din who's capable of ruling on capital crimes to at least rule that he's a rotzeach, to hear the case, to hear the testimony. That they argue that Goel Hadam is not complete Western style vigilantism. If beis din hears the case and hears testimony and rules that so and so has the status of a murderer, then they'll issue a permission for the relatives to execute. But you need Sanhedrin, or at least a beis din that has jurisdiction over capital crime to do that. And we don't have that today. So the Chavos Yoyer and others, except the Choshen, have argued that we can't have Goel Hadam today because we don't have courts that are capable of ruling on capital cases. Right.
So,
I agree that that's a crucial point. Certainly, according to the Achronim who are arguing that you need a proper Sanhedrin or based enough 23 to rule, even without that, you need some kind of due process. You need Edim. You need something. How can the Torah just allow people on their own say so? There's a fundamental, very fundamental absence of any kind of due process here. That is a good question. I don't know, again, probably beyond the scope. I didn't prepare the full material of Goel Hadam, so I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. It's possible the Torah is not necessarily saying that should be permitted l'chatchila. It's just discussing what might happen. The Torah says, ki yechem levavo, not necessarily clear that everything there is stuff that we would condone ab initio, but it's at least saying that it may happen and there may be no, but that is an important question, yes. There are those, though, who argue that you don't need Sanhedrin, that you don't need, and that you don't actually need this kind of due process. You don't need a formal verdict of the Sanhedrin as long as you know firsthand or you know through a fully reliable Edim, whatever you need, that it happened. There are those who disagree with the due process requirement. This is a debate, again, beyond the scope of today's talk, but this is actually a discussion of the Achronim. Just returning to some of the tshuvas that we quoted, the Tzemach Tzedek, in his tshuva, he's discussing, again, not vigilantism, but he's discussing going to the prosecuting in court. He actually feels that falls into Goel Hadam too, that he says, Goel Hadam, if you can't do it yourself, the next best thing, or you can do it however you can. If you can kill the murderer yourself, if you can arrange for him to be punished through the legal system, that's also good. He therefore argues that is also included in the mitzvah of Goel Hadam. That part of the mitzvah of Goel Hadam is to secure justice however you can. Besides the question of deterrence, he says, which as we discussed earlier, is a communal obligation. The first half of the tshuva deals with Goel Hadam and says the family of the victim, the family itself of the victim has a particular obligation to do whatever it can, at least up to a certain point, up to a person doesn't have to spend all his money for a mitzvah, but up to a certain amount, he says, like as for other mitzvahs, they should spend money to get this done. Beyond that amount, he says, beyond what they can afford, then it's the community's duty because of deterrence. But the mitzvah of Goel Hadam, there is debate in the poskim about how far Goel Hadam goes, which relatives, whether it's really true that indirect Goel Hadam is included, whether Goel Hadam can include going through the court system. These are all topics for a different discussion. But the bottom line is we have deterrence in general. We have the idea that it's good for the spirit of the murder victim. And then we have the idea of Goel Hadam, the mitzvah upon the relatives of a victim to avenge his murder.